As I was writing my lessons on Isaiah, chapters 41 and 42, it occurred to me that I needed to lay some serious foundations as to what the faith of ancient Israel actually was during the monarchy in exile, what their mindset was, and their view of reality. It can be really difficult to relate to the ancient Israelites at times because we're born into a largely monotheistic world. We look at what happened at Sinai with the golden calf and during the time of the judges and the downward spiral of 1st and 2nd Kings, and we wonder how on earth could they not understand that they were breaking the first commandment to have no other gods before Yahweh? Why didn't they see a problem with worshiping Yahweh and other gods on the side? You know, but the ancients didn't think the way we do. And the word monotheism, which is the exclusive worship and recognition of the existence of only one ultimate God, didn't exist. The closest approximation to monotheism in the ancient world was actually atheism, because a belief in and worship of only one God just didn't make any sense to the people of the ancient world. And I'm wanting to teach this to you today because, frankly, the scholarship that you see out there in Moch teachings, and especially in the Hebrew Roots movement, as to what pagans did and how they believed, it's not informed. People actually don't study. What they do is they make a lot of assumptions based on what they think ancient religions look like, and they don't look at the writings about ancient religions in the words of the people who actually lived there. They have a lot of assumptions about idols. They have a lot of assumptions about paganism and stuff in general. And a lot of it's based on New Age, which actually isn't even based, and Wicca and all that stuff isn't actually even based on legitimate ancient religion, but it's based on the romantic writings of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, when they weren't archaeologists, they didn't know, and so they made up these romantic tales, and a lot of people took that and felt that they were historical, which they weren't. And archaeology has since, in the last 150 years, completely blown away a lot of what people have thought about paganism. And especially even the writings of, like, the propaganda of Alexander Hislop in the 1850s have been completely proved falsified and bogus by actual scholarship from people, and not always people who are believers, but just archaeologists and people who study the hundreds of thousands of ancient documents that have been unearthed from that portion of the world over the past 150 years, and especially since the unlocking of the Rosetta Stone has allowed us to read a lot of these different languages of the people groups that are written about in the Bible. And so we're able to look at the Bible now, and we're able to say, oh my gosh, so that's what they believed, and this is why. And it's really fascinating, and I studied this about 5 years ago, 4 years ago. I can't remember, in great depth. It really opened up a lot of the scripture for me. Anyway, hi, I'm Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and welcome to Character in Context, where I teach the historical an ancient sociological context of scripture with an eye to developing the character of Messiah. If you prefer written material, I have 5 years worth of blog at theancientbridge.com, as well as transcripts of going on most of my programs now. I've got 6 books available on Amazon, including a 4-volume curriculum series dedicated to teaching scriptural context in a way that even kids can understand it, called Context for Kids. And I have 2 video channels on YouTube and free Bible teachings for both adults and kids. You can find the link for those on my website, and past broadcasts of this program can be found at characterincontext.podbean.com, including last week's beginning to this whole series, Isaiah and the Messiah, Part 1, starting with overview of Isaiah 1 through 39 and Isaiah 40. But without further ado, let's get into this week's teaching. In Isaiah 40 through 55, we see this common theme as we will cover more in the upcoming weeks, of Yahweh having to challenge the belief of his people that he was unable to save them. This was their mindset. Because he'd been, one, defeated by the Babylonian gods in their mind, and two, that he had no authority outside of Israel anyway. And this, even though it sounds crazy to us, monotheists, this was a very reasonable assumption in the ancient world. This was how everyone looked at things. Monotheism was crazy and weird. But what were the Israelites? If they weren't monotheists, then what is the alternative? Were they polytheists? Monolaters? Henotheists? Let's go through each of these and use the biblical account to see where they line up. Because it's going to change the way we read practically the entire first two-thirds of the Bible. Now, what was the norm? Why so many gods? And how did the ancients view their gods? How did the ancients view their idols? That's really important because this is a point that a lot of people don't understand. And it makes reading Isaiah a lot more difficult. Now, gods and goddesses were all about function and dominion. Someone had to be responsible for the rain, and it certainly couldn't be the same one responsible for the sunshine, because the functions of sun and rain were entirely different. Duh, right? Therefore, in their minds, there had to be more than one god, and in the case of Hittites, they had thousands of them. This is the basis of polytheism, which is the recognition and worship of many gods, gods who are not jealous in nature and who do not demand exclusive allegiance. In other words, Marduk doesn't care if you're seeing Ishtar on the side, and she doesn't care if you're also seeing Enki. In fact, they expected you to. Yes, I know they're fictional. Go with me here. Marduk was the national god supporting kingship, and Ishtar was the goddess of prostitution and war, and Enki was the goddess of wisdom. You can't just neglect one. All of them had to be honored in society, or society will fall apart, and of course, those were not the only three. They also needed mother goddesses and agricultural goddesses, and they needed a sun god. They needed, you know, all that jazz. All that jazz. They had gods for everything. Now, the polytheistic gods were entirely different from the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. One, they were not moral in nature. They had no set standards of conduct that you had to live up to, no knowable expectations, and so the people who worshiped them had no idea whatsoever how to please or displease them. I mean, they had to be taken care of, and we'll get to that. In the polytheistic world, if you made a god angry, then bad things started happening to you. The problem was, which god did you make angry? How did you do it? There was absolutely no way to know for sure. And so, in the ancient cuneiform tablets, we see an account of a woman who is desperately seeking forgiveness, but she's writing. She has no idea what she's done or to who. Now, if you're being cursed by an unknown god, it was serious business. You had to start repenting of everything you can think of, to every god imaginable. You had to start making, I think John Walton called it the sacrificial tour, trying to appease these gods whom you have supposedly done something to offend. Your friends start avoiding you because they don't want the gods angry at them by association. Now, I want you real quick to maybe consider the book of Job in a new light, because Job is worded in a really interesting way. With the exception of the very beginning and the very end, when the actual actions of Yahweh are being discussed, the actual name of Yahweh is only mentioned twice in Job 12:9 and 28:28, and both times by Job. He says, "Who knoweth not in all these that the hand of the Lord has wrought these?" Oh, man. Yet, of course, I had to have the King James up when I cut and pasted. "And unto man," he said, "behold, the fear of God, that is wisdom, and to bark from evil is understanding." Now, every other reference is to the generic term God, or Elohim, is the Hebrew that's translated God, or El. And most folks assume that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was always being referred to by everyone here, but you know, I reread this in light of all this years ago. And I see two different pictures of God being presented. One from the ancient Near Eastern polytheistic mindset of a God whose standards are unknown and must be appeased. And the other, Job's, in line with Yahweh, whose standards can be known and which Job knows he has not transgressed. You know, like the account of the woman who doesn't know who the heck she offended or how, Job's friends are desperately trying to get him to repent for, you know, whatever he's done. After all, in the A&E, community was everything. A&E meaning ancient Near East. Sorry if I say that again, you know. And Job was placing them all in jeopardy by refusing to just admit to a whole bunch of things that he hasn't even done. But, you know, the gods don't really know. The gods can't read your thoughts, so if you're repenting stuff of you haven't done, they don't know. You know, it's not the thought that counts, it's the words that count with the pagan gods, all right? So, as the chapters wear on and Job keeps protesting his innocence, his friends get more and more determined that he's done something to deserve all this trouble. And Job gets more and more belligerent until their accusations finally lead Job into a place where he makes the mistake of saying that he, and not God, is in the right. But it all comes down to clashing worldviews and different ideas about God and the gods. This is the ancient Near Eastern world. Now, another reason that we struggle with understanding Israel's continual fall into idolatry is because we do not understand faith in the ancient world. Nowadays, we have nice little boxes where we compartmentalize everything in our lives. You know, we make a differentiation, between the sacred and the secular in society. That's the world we were brought into. But in the ancient world, there's no such division. That division's very modern. There was no such thing as religion in the ancient world because every aspect of life was religious. So no religion is a separate thing. There was no such... there was the ever-present ancestral worship that we see in the story of Laban and Rachel. The teraphim she took would have been the representation of Laban's ancestors, and the caring for these idols was a very grave responsibility that Laban would have taken very seriously, or, you know, his ancestors were in trouble in the grave. Losing these idols would have been beyond traumatic for the entire family. Now, this next part is vital to understanding the hyperbole, which is a literary word for exaggeration. For the hyperbole and idol polemics in Isaiah. And polemic, of course, is a Greek term that means, I call it Hellenistic insult, even though you see it further back than the Hellenists, but it's just the word we use. So, idol insults in Isaiah. We often think that the ancients viewed their idols as the god itself, but nothing could be further from the truth. The idols were simply representations of the god, which the people would care for and in so doing care for the god by proxy. These idols, you gotta know, they had their own temples, right? And of course the temple is palace for the god. The priests are the palace staff. So they were dressed in the morning, these idols. I'm serious. Dressed in the morning in finery. And so when you're looking at different, like Jeremiah, is it Jeremiah 8 or Jeremiah 10, where a lot of people think it's talking about a Christmas tree. No, it's talking about the making of an idol and the stuff that they would dress it in. Okay? They would dress them in gold and silk and finery like a king, because that's what their gods were. They were kings to them. Anyway, they would dress them in the morning. They would feed them. They would give them drink. Oh, the finest, too. I mean, the finest food and drink. They would bathe them. They would oil them the way they would do a king's head and feet. And they would actually put them to bed. I kid you not. Now, in this way, they thought that they were caring for the god the way a palace staff would care for an actual king. Then this freed up the god to do their cosmic jobs, and which was contributing to the general order and well-being of the world. Okay? A happy god, after all, is a non-interfering god, and they didn't really want the gods interfering in their lives because they were too unpredictable and amoral. Okay, amoral as opposed to immoral. Amoral means they had no morals whatsoever. Immoral means you have bad morals. And at least immoral gods would always do something bad. Amoral gods are just flighty and unpredictable. You don't know what they're going to do. Anyway, they're too immoral and unpredictable to be trusted. This caring for idols would have been normal and unquestioned by the mixed multitude that came out of Egypt, and probably by the Israelites as well at that point. You know, a lot of people don't like to think about this, but somehow Aaron knew how to make an idol and didn't seem to protest that the making of an idol would be breaking the commandment. The covenant, you know, the commandments that they just agreed to. That right there is our first clue as to what was going on in the minds of the Israelites and why they seemed unable to really grasp what was being demanded of them. You see, polytheism is the more than the worship of many gods. It is to have gods who don't even remotely care if you're seeing other gods on the side. The worship of the main city god in the ancient world was the job of the priests and kings. And the common people worshiped the household gods. They had pantry gods, which were snakes to keep the mice away. Very useful. Ancestral teraphim, the god of the hearth, and a number of other minor deities that kept the home safe. It may very well be that the rank and file Israelites, despite the commandment to only worship one god, felt that paying attention to the minor deities didn't really count as a transgression. Maybe they only considered it super bad when something happened, like when King Ahaz actually replaced the altar of Yahweh in the temple with a replica of the altar he saw and made sacrifices on when he was in Damascus. Major bad mojo. Now, I am not excusing them, but I am trying to explain how the ancients saw the world of the divine and what they had to overcome, and why, once they were in the land, they were commanded not to associate with the Canaanites at all, not ever. The Canaanites had gods of the hills and gods of the valleys, gods of the harvest and gods for this and for that, and the temptation would be very great to bow down and worship those gods and serve them if one was concerned that the harvest wasn't going to come in. You know, hey Baal, please send the rain. That was his job. He was a storm god. Or if enemies attacked and you wanted the favor of the regional deities in battle. That is why the commandment was given in Deuteronomy 12 not to learn the ways of the peoples of the land, because this was their approach to life. And it was very tempting to follow them into it during times of testing and trial. And the temptation has always been there to describe the religion of the Israelites as always having been monotheistic. But truthfully, until after the exile, it never was. Israel was always worshiping other gods on the side. Even King David had an idol in his home. 1 Samuel 19:13. And Michael, David's wife, took an image, and in Hebrew it's teraph, and laid it in the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster and covered it with a cloth. It was obviously big enough that it could masquerade for a human sleeping in a bed. Now, Solomon, who started out so well, was influenced by his wives to build temples to all of their gods. Temples which remained until the days of Josiah and the great covenant renewal during his reign. You know, we see good kings forever having to tear down idols in high places and bad kings building them back up again. At one point, there was even idolatry going on in the very temple of God, as we see in Ezekiel 8. That's the chapter that actually got me started studying all this in the first place back in 2015. starting in verse 10. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping things and abominable beasts, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed on the walls all around. And there stood before them 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel. It's the elders. And in the midst of them stood Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan, and every man his censer in his hand, incense censer, and a thick cloud of incense went up. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. And behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. He was the agricultural god of Babylon. And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house. And behold, at the door of the temple of the altar of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east. Astral worship, very popular in Babylon. Now, back in verses 3 and 5, which I didn't read, it refers to images of jealousy, which of course is absolutely unique to Yahweh. No other god would have been jealous as long as they themselves were worshipped also, you know, but Yahweh's exclusive and brooks no competition. And I know there's attempts to make this image of jealousy be some sort of sexual image, as somehow that would make people jealous, but that wouldn't make people jealous in the ancient world. That is very modern thinking. Any idol is an image of jealousy, especially when it's in the temple. Any idol. Because it's provoking his jealousy. So Yahweh's exclusive, brooks no competition, and yet the overwhelming majority of people really seem to have no problem with this whatsoever. The reason for this is something called henotheism. So we've done monotheism, we've done polytheism, now we're going to talk about henotheism. Henotheism is the primary worship of one of a group of gods, while not denying the others or necessarily ignoring them. Because of this mindset, idolatry was tolerated and even flourished. After all, this system put Yahweh, henotheism, put Yahweh at the top of the pyramid, but all the while recognizing the other gods as minor deities, and so Israel saw herself as faithful even though she was committing spiritual adultery. In the henotheistic mindset, it is okay to acknowledge Baal or Ashtoreth or Asherah as regional gods with local control, as long as the main focus of your worship is Yahweh. Obviously, to us at least, this was not acceptable to the one true God, and it doesn't make any sense to us, but that was the culture. Just, you know, you've tried breaking out of culture, it's not easy. Monolatry, which we do not see in the Bible, is very similar to henotheism, and it is what we see in Mormonism, the belief that there are many gods, but that it is only acceptable to worship one, the god of, you know, your planet. The other gods have no jurisdiction, and therefore they are not to be worshipped. Monolatry is, I guess I could call it, exclusive polytheism. You can only worship one god, but there are a great many. All right, I hope that makes sense. So, henotheism and not monotheism is what we see going on in ancient Israel. Whereas other nations only worshipped their own gods and were therefore polytheistic, Israel worshipped Yahweh and the gods of all the other nations around them to varying degrees of severity over the years. In this way, they were far more unfaithful than the nations around them, and why they were constantly being called on the table for whoredom, for spiritual adultery, for as being prostitutes, is everything. The Moabites were not worshiping the Egyptian gods, and the Egyptians were not worshiping the Phoenician gods. Everyone but Israel worshiped their own god. Well, and the Hittites. The Hittites are just this unique situation. Now, The Egyptians recognized the Phoenician gods and the Moabite gods as being absolutely real, but they weren't the gods of the Egyptians. Okay? They were centered in other countries and therefore weren't a concern. Be right back. Hey, this is Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and welcome back to Character in Context. You know, last week I started the series on Isaiah and the Messiah, and we're covering Isaiah 40 through 55, verse by verse in context, because it is very, very often taken out of context by people who just, they have agendas, they want to quote a small portion in order to bolster what it is they want to say, and sometimes they do that at the expense of the text, at the expense of the historical realities, at the expense of actually looking what kind of literature it is. And so they pull something, they say, well, this means this. And sadly, a lot of these people are luring people away from the Messiah by just taking little snippets and saying, well, this means this. Well, Isaiah is not easy to understand. Isaiah is ancient lyrical poetry. Isaiah has salvation oracles, disputation oracles, idol polemics, all sorts of things. Because it's poetry, we have to be careful with how much we make of different verb tenses and how things are expressed, and taking some things literally in ways they were not intended. We also have to look at the historical context. So that is absolutely what we're doing here. It's probably going to be about 4 months worth of stuff. But I was, like I said, the first half, I was getting ready to record Isaiah 42 and 43. And then I realized, oh my gosh, all these idol polemics. If I don't describe why ancient Israel felt the way they do about idols and why the ancient world saw them, because most of what's believed today, and especially, you know, I look at memes and I look at all this stuff and I'm going, you know, the people who made these memes and the people who are saying this, they just don't understand how the ancients saw their idols, how they saw idolatry being completely misrepresented because of modern, like within the last 300 years, romantic literature written by people who were not archaeologists, who were just saying, well, if I was doing that, this is what it would mean to me. Well, this isn't what it meant to them, and we know that because over the last 150 years, archaeology in the ancient world, in the ancient Near East, has exploded, and we know so much now that we didn't know 150 years ago, and it's blown a lot of stuff that people were saying beforehand just out of the water, and it's brought the biblical text into so much more, into living color, and we are more knowing what they knew when they wrote it. All right, so here we go back to the thing, and we were talking about, when we left off, we were talking about how the Moabites didn't worship Egyptian gods. Egyptians weren't worshiping the Canaanite gods. You know, everyone but Israel was actually worshiping their own gods. And all the different countries, they really did believe that other countries' gods were real and powerful. But they didn't think that they had authority in their own country, which is, you know, will make why Pharaoh wasn't taking Yahweh seriously, you know, at all. It make more sense. All right, so idolatry in Israel didn't start with Solomon, because we were talking about Solomon bringing in his 300 wives and his 600 concubines, and he made temples for all of his foreign wives. And I mean, that's a lot of temples. Hopefully there was some overlap, because dang. Now, Solomon didn't invent idolatry in Israel. He just made an existing situation far worse. You know, according to the Bible, as soon as Joshua, Caleb, and those who conquered the land died, Israel immediately started doing things according to the ways of the Canaanites that they had failed to drive out. And so I want to talk about the difference between Yahweh and the gods of the nations, because there is talk out in the secular scholarly world that monotheism was just the natural evolution of religion. Quite the contrary, though. There was no evolution at all. It was commanded and resisted until exile drove the Jews to the realization that Yahweh really meant business with this exclusivity jealousy stuff, and he was not going to tolerate it anymore. And even during the exile, as we see, we will see in our Isaiah studies, they still had to be convinced, although, you know, we talked about that a little last week. The gods of the nations were like us. They had beginnings. They had endings. They were born and they reproduced, and sometimes they were even conquered by other gods and died. So when you hear someone say, well, where did God come from? They never ask where the Big Bang stuff came from. And I say this as a scientist, okay? They say, where did God come from? But that's a very ancient Near Eastern mindset. Like the people of the ancient Near Eastern world, their gods, the gods of the people in the ancient Near Eastern world, did not operate according to any wrong versus right code of conduct. Not that the people didn't have laws for ordered living, mind you, that's different, but their gods weren't scolding them for immorality. They were functional gods, each god having a jurisdiction and unable to go outside of it. Ra of the Egyptians was the sun god. And if you've ever seen those little the obelisks, they're named obelisk because obeliskoi is the Greek word for meat skewer. And they believed that at the height of the day, when Ra was tired, he could rest at the top of the sun needle as he rode himself across the sky. We've got this, you know, in actual ancient Egyptian documents. And of course, he fought Apophis all night. And for you Stargate fans, you're probably laughing because, you know, there's all this stuff that they incorporated. But they were gods who could get tired, and they were gods that had their own jobs. Ra wasn't doing Osiris's job. Osiris was the god of the underworld, of the dead. And Osiris could not row the sun bark across the sky, even if they wanted to. The gods all operated within a large community of gods, and they fought and debated and made decisions. Their job was to run their own particular cosmic functions, keeping everything in order. Nothing was more important to the ancient Near Eastern mind than order, because the opposite of that was chaos in the form of famine, drought, pestilence, barrenness, death, and defeat at the hands of one's enemies. The only reason that the people of the ancient world believed that they were, they believed that they were created in the first place was to do all the work for the gods, who were bored after having created the world and wanted to be cared for. You know, therefore, as I mentioned before, the priests and kings were responsible for taking care of the major city deities. They were like the palace staff, and the temple was the palace. The common people never bothered with the big gods, but instead took care of their own household gods. And now I want you to just think about what it meant for them to be a nation of priests and kings. Or a kingdom of priests is actually a better translation. It means that they were all responsible for worshiping Yahweh, who was to be their only god. That's what that means, all right? Now, but in pagan nations, they didn't have to worry about the big kahuna gods. They just had to worry about their teraphim, their ancestor idols, so they could take care of their ancestors in the grave, in Sheol, and just their household gods. So the fire wouldn't go out in the hearth, which was a big deal. All right. Now, as long as Baal was taken care of by the priests, by the city priest, given food and drink, he was free to manage the agricultural fertility of the land. If he was not taken care of, he might get distracted and everyone could die of hunger. I'm serious. Their gods were lame. And I mean, it's kind of funny that they just were kind of incompetent. Now, Yahweh, on the other hand, did all the work of creation not for himself, but for the people he was creating. That's the purpose of Genesis 1, right there. Instead of creating a race of slaves to take care of him, he took care of the needs of the people and created for them a day of rest. He had absolute standards of right and wrong, so his people knew whether or not they had transgressed. He cared for the least of these and not just for heroes and kings. So from Genesis 1, we see a God diametrically opposed to the ancient Near Eastern gods. As I mentioned before, he is jealous, unlike ancient Near Eastern gods. He doesn't break his own rules, unlike ancient Near Eastern God. He has no beginning and no end. He doesn't need to be fed or dressed. He doesn't need other gods to help him with the functioning of the universe. He refuses to allow his creation to create an idol to represent him. However, that doesn't mean he can't create a human being to represent him and place his spirit in. I mean, after all, he did create humanity in the first place to be image bearers and to be like him. It is not much of a diversion after that to create a Messiah, to have his spirit in. All right, now, Yahweh is the absolute antithesis of everything that was being worshipped in the ancient world, and so, although the accounts of ancient myths might have literary similarities to the scriptures and follow the patterns of time, the information in the Bible conveyed in the Bible is generally the exact opposite. Yahweh used the literary conventions of the day to say things like, okay, I want you to see me being enthroned in Genesis 1, and I want you to see the blueprint of who I am relationally to my people, so I am using this recognized literary style of temple text. But in the midst of it, I am going to show you how entirely different I am from every false god. And in Isaiah, we come across a number of paradigms that the Israelites had been living with for over 1,000 years. Yahweh spends chapters and chapters addressing this mindset. Not that there were chapters when it was written. Never mind. You know what I mean. Chapters are modern, but you know we have to break it up somehow because we can't find stuff otherwise. Now, first up, in the ancient world, when one country was defeated, or when one country defeated another country, sorry, it was actually a case of one country's gods defeating the other country's gods. So, in the eyes of the people, the Babylonian gods were mightier than Yahweh, and they had proved it. Not only when they conquered Jerusalem and led away his people into exile, but even more so when they destroyed his temple. In their minds, they weren't seeing and hearing what the prophets had been saying. Well, I mean, some were, but not most. What the prophets had been saying about how Yahweh was going to hand them over for destruction on purpose, and the city, and his temple, because they had made everything so disgusting that he couldn't stand it anymore. And he was literally going to use the Babylonian Empire as a janitorial service. Break down the walls, deport the people so they can't defile the land anymore, and burn Solomon's temple and the palace he built right beside it, up to the temple, you know, up on the Temple Mount. He actually built his palace right next to the original temple, all right? Well, not the original. The original temple was in Shiloh, but we're not going to do that. Okay. The original big Temple Mount temple. Okay. But we will see in chapter 42, the temple we see in 1 Samuel was actually a building in Shiloh. And they talk about that in scripture. It's kind of a halfway point between the tabernacle and the temple. Anyway, so the original Solomon built his palace right next to the temple, which Yahweh had some words about. But we'll see in chapter 42 or 43, I can't remember which right now, that they still don't get the picture that this exile wasn't Yahweh being conquered. It's their punishment. It's while it's chapter 42. And we will see that they weren't publicly worshiping him in exile either. They were treating him like an absentee, defeated, powerless god. Yahweh repeatedly assures them that he's going to do what no gods have ever done before, which is restore a defeated nation from exile. He tells them that the upcoming deliverance will be more glorious than the exodus out of Egypt. He makes a ton of stunning predictions, which brings us to the next point about the gods of the nations. They didn't make prophetic predictions. Oh, sure. You know, there are legends of the oracle at Delphi delivering vague predictions. That could go either way in stories about pronouncements in literature, in fiction. But we have zero religious literature referring to any pagan gods predicting what would happen in the future and having it come to pass. So we need to learn about the law of continuity in order to explain this. And there are many laws of continuity, but this is the one concerning pagan gods. The law of continuity, in a nutshell, says that nothing ever changes. Life goes on as it always has. In the ancient world, this was pretty much true. The concept of a quote-unquote new thing was just foreign in the extreme. No nation had ever been delivered and restored from exile, therefore no country ever could be delivered and restored from exile. That was their mindset. It's why Pharaoh wasn't scared of Yahweh's threats. It's why Israel in exile had lost hope and had to not only be encouraged, but also re-educated. Yahweh had lost. He was gone. Often Israel far away and powerless, totally shamed. They had no protector. They had no nation and no hope. Life was pretty good in Babylon, and they were prospering even though they were a conquered people. Better to just, you know, give up and learn to like it. And so, starting next week in Isaiah 41, Yahweh is going to have to start making some startling predictions, and he will literally be challenging the gods of the nations to a prediction duel. It's going to be so much fun. Here's what I say will happen. What do you say will happen? Hello? Hey. Say something, do something, anything. No? Didn't think so. Another thing you need to realize as we're going through the idol polemics is that they do not paint an accurate picture of idolatry in the ancient world. And they weren't supposed to. Isaiah wasn't going for historical accuracy here. He wasn't trying to teach them about idolatry. They knew about idolatry. This was a polemic, which is, remember, it's insulting speech, designed to portray the idols and those who worship them as ridiculous in the extreme. It is mocking the mindset and practices of the ancient world by twisting what they were doing out of context, but in a way that highlights the truth and the fact that idols cannot compete with Yahweh in any way. Isaiah knew what real idolatry looked like. He knew how it worked, and he knew what the priests were thinking and doing. I mean, everyone knew. Writing a boring treatise on that wouldn't have convinced anyone how silly it was. As it was, it made sense to them, and so he had to create sort of a Frankenstein's monster out of it. Real and very grotesque, and a caricature of the real thing. Because the real thing looked pretty reasonable to them. Now remember, these were the children and grandchildren of idolaters, not the children and grandchildren of monotheists. It's so important to understand the literature types, and especially when reading the prophets. Isaiah is largely lyrical poetry, you know, peppered here and there with polemics and disputations, and next week we're going to start with the disputation, which is going to be really fun, and salvation oracles, and historical accounts. And they're woven into one another, but you need to understand what you're reading when, and there's also multiple voices, and you need to understand who's talking and when. When people take a verse out of context and fail to explain the literary genre of the passage, it's very easy to make that verse mean something entirely different than it was intended to mean, and nowhere do we see that more than with the idol polemics. I have seen them used in order to discount Yeshua, or you may call him Jesus, as the Messiah, when in context, they have nothing to do with the existence or even the possibility of an existence of a divine Messiah at all, and were only applicable to the idols that the Israelites were fearing and crediting with more power than Yahweh in their exile. But it takes a lot of time and effort to learn to read the different literary styles of Isaiah, and either the people who are misrepresenting it honestly haven't studied it in this sort of literary and historical context, or they're just blinded by agenda. Because nowhere in Isaiah does it disqualify a Messiah being born to embody the spirit of Yahweh and deliver his people and the nations as his strong right arm, and quite the opposite. This is why I'm taking the time to teach it all, you know, line by line, and making sure that everyone understands the context. When to and not to take verb tenses literally. In poetic works, it can be tricky with the Hebrew prophetic perfect tense. That was hard to say. Okay. And to understand why the gospel writers and the Qumran community, which some people think are the Essenes, and they might have been, and David Kimhi, a very famous Talmudic rabbi, and Barbanel, they're both rabbis, and others, great Torah scholars, saw the Messiah clearly in Isaiah. It is worth taking the time to do this. And when people tell you that Isaiah is so easy to understand that even a child can understand it, that's just nonsense. If that was true, then we wouldn't see so many commentaries from all sides over the past 2,500 years, including among the Jews, saying so many different things about it. Those are the words of people who want to tell you exactly how a child reads it, in order to shame you into thinking that if you don't agree, then children are more clever than you are. It's just a manipulative ploy. It's so easy that a child can understand it, but they still try to teach you, you know, because having it be so a child can understand it isn't enough. You need their interpretation too. See, they don't really believe what they're saying. It isn't easy and it isn't self-evident. It's an ancient document that needs to be treated with the utmost respect and studied in depth, and not just read over at a shallow level and then presumed to be understood. None of us are that smart. We no longer know what the author knew. We are not familiar, neither are modern Jews for that matter, because modern Judaism's way different than it was in biblical times. And then there's the cultural stuff. We just don't know it. We are not familiar with how ancient authors expressed things. And most of all, you know, Yahweh is smarter than we are and cleverer. And he did not give his word to us in a form that everything is a no-brainer. I always say, if the scriptures were really a no-brainer, then every single Jew who reads the scriptures faithfully would get that Yeshua is the Messiah. But look, do we really expect God to be found intellectually if you're just smart enough? Is that what we believe? It's not what I believe. I don't believe that finding God is an intellectual process at all. I believe that the person with profound Down syndrome is just as able to find God as the person with a 160 IQ. Maybe more likely. I don't know. It just depends. It's not about smarts. You know, the truth is, most everyone reads Isaiah with an agenda and not to see actually what is and what is not there. And that's so sad, because it is just beautiful and wonderful. It's the words of God. You know, and that's exactly why we see what we want to see. It's called confirmation bias. You know, if you are led to believe that Yeshua is found on every page of the Bible, then you'll find him there even when the connections are dubious in the extreme. So if you don't want Yeshua to be the Messiah, well, you will find stuff out of context that clearly says he's not the Messiah. If you know he is the Messiah, then you will see him fulfilling everything, if not already, then in the future. So, you know, we have to know what we believe and not just read Isaiah in order to prove ourselves right. That is self-idolatry right there. I mean, I know that the Yeshua is the Messiah experientially. I know him. I'm not looking in Isaiah to prove or disprove that I'm right, because I've already experienced the new creation miracle in my life, and it is ongoing. What more proof do I need to know he is the real deal? Well, none. You know, it's not about proving I'm right. It's about worshiping him, knowing him, and making him known. And that isn't an intellectual exercise. Anyway, next week we are going to start talking about Isaiah 41. And we have got some really funny stuff we're going to go through. Funny, but not funny. Bye.